Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Well, happy 2014. We lost a really big tree in the forest recently. Baba Amiri Baraka made his transition. He is now with the ancestors, and his funeral is Friday, January 17th in New Jersey. I think it's in New Jersey. I'll give you the details shortly. But I wanted to play this piece by Billy Harper, Knowledge of Self, which features Amiri Baraka doing some poetry. And then we're going to rebroadcast a show where Baba Baraka talked about the Malcolm X and the recent publication of a book about his life that was very controversial. Alrighty, so first we're going to play Knowledge of Self, and then I will be back with some details about where his services are taking place and more information about the show that he was on a couple of years ago.
Fletcher's grandness, the heir to his big bandness, was a master arrived to forever lay out the blue wonderfulness of the orchestra, Duke Ellington, whose greatness transcends all trends. Duke told Max, don't let them call your music jazz, cause they can make anything that. What prophecy, cold and true. Why, they can say what your boy, what's-his-name, Elevated G is playing, is that you dig? But then, what's-his-name was the king of jazz. And what's the other dude was the king of swing? And we now up to in that alley, banging on them tin pans, they called it swing. But they meant a noun, not a verb. Never could get the verb in it. Remember all them ladies and men, masters and mistresses of the verbal thing? Ethel Waters in her blue, new American classical popular song, and Billy, who reached the deepest tear in our heart, and Ella, all flying off them wonderful bands who carried our hearts, our meaning in their songs. The royalty like Duke and the Count of Basie, the lady who made her alliance with the real American president, Mr. Young, and you know they swung. Bean, the mighty hawk, taught us all how Lewis sounded on another horn, and the cats in their band, Duke's people at the top of the steeple, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney, Cootie Williams, Cat Anderson, Paul Gonzales, Ben Webster, and other greats who morphed into another age. If the 20s was the jazz age, then the 30s, the Great Depression, people seemed like they got skinny. But the age of swing, from all those songs, the world was looking for love, but it seemed like there wasn't any. Goose stepping in Europe, Payne in Spain, they was painting mustaches on the Mona Lisa and putting a commode in the museum. Had civilization stopped? My man Helene said they couldn't stop bebop, and they won't stop hip-hop. Bird Blue, Dizzy New, Max carried our original earth to this place where we grew. Bud smiled, then here come miles, there was a bee and a bop. It's just another beat, another B and another act. where the is and the unis cohabit the same frame. But the sound was a verb, not a noun, unless you couldn't Congo style really get down our share shake. But then the could did, and then them original hipsters appeared with the Vance and the Bowdy O'Rooney. Said you gotta have them black notes, actually they is blue. I want my fist flatted. And you gotta have the drum where we and the music come from. Dig, that word was the first I heard. It all can't be on paper. For the proper syncopation, you gotta have improvisation. We gonna take them tired chords and make our own songs, our own stories. Otherwise it's too dull, it don't swing, it ain't hip. We said we wanted wild, crazy, frantic. We wanted it to be exactly like us. Gone from the square world or out to lunch. My man Symphony Sid from the jazz corner of the world. It sounded like there was never anything before as hip as Birdland and this lullaby where I first heard the divine one. Sassy say, you're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy for a girl like me. What? And we heard of Fats Navarro and Fat Girl and Kenny Clark and Klug and Long Tall Dexter Gordon and Stan Getz and Zoot Sims. We heard the hippest people in the world. But remember, when you go out, somebody's gonna try to bring you back in. Bop was too hot, the anti-bop squad say. Too fast, too crazy. Crazy, we said. The counterattack was to bring it back. Y'all been out to lunch too long, whether it was swing or bebop, Dizzy Dream. If you wanted a cop, you had to hit the street. No road out of the jungle, that's 52nd Street, where the Charleston hit the New York docks. 12th Avenue was a shock. From Angola to the gullahs in South Carolina, got the first thing smoke, went up to New York. Charleston, James P. wrote, to greet those who landed in the devil's northern house. Hell's Kitchen, to be exact. San Juan Hill, Monk and Benny Carter's home, where Lincoln Center sits still. That's right. He on the only money that ain't white. But what we was trying to say, when it got too hot, some folks tipped away from that street. I think it was the heat. Last seen heading west, they next address. It was cool, really cool. Some said, calm down. Miles said, get down. Stan heard, Kloof, Budo, Jerry heard, Lee heard, John Lewis heard, Gil Evans heard, Poncho Haygood heard. They gave birth to the school, the real birth of the cool. When the memory of the hip starts to slip, the gorgeous blue, the funk we knew, they're gonna bend their knees and raise it back from the mood indigo that flows out of the black. What was bad could be bad. Much, much better than that. Thus spoke Nat. So when cool started to fool with my man JoJo's soul, he went out and put the church in. Where them Negroes' eyes be rolling back in their head and start speaking some stuff ain't never been said. A dude named Buhana played them drums like he was insane. I'm from the blue continent of dark under your heartbeat. Dudes named Horace drug the funky gospel into the joints, hollering, let me see what you do with your shovel. And the Holy Ghost popping his tambourine, chick-a-ching, rattling the room. That's nasty when you bring Africa and the Lord in like that. He wanted the messengers from the Holy Ghost Mau Mau Baptist Church, and they got a message from Kenyon 125th Street. The University of Blakey, the Academy of, well, it might have seemed like that, but it really was this. Where you could dig Hank Mobley and listen nobly to the man Boo called the uncrowned king, Kenny Dorham. But always so many others came to fill up the space with names of that school, Clifford Brown, Luke Donaldson, Percy Heath, Donald Byrd, Jack McLean, Lee Morgan, Benny Golson, all the way to Billy Harper and Wynton Marsalis. What all that was is the saving of the deep historical vaunts, the blues, the ancient call and response from across the trees and through the woods so you know where I am and I wait for your response. Our blue life memory all the way back across the world. The zigzag of chance, the improv, and fix however to the mighty drum, the rhythm of life, what has no beat cannot stay. What was called hard bop was something to wake us up again to the rhythm of ourselves. Max and Brownie, along with Buhana, helped bring the fire back. The post-cool smoke fanned from the wings of the great bird, but now the heavy motion would be by train. We call that band of Miles the Hydrogen Bomb and Switchblade Band. Paul and Red, Cannonball, the Funkus, Mad Philly Joe and Train, the monster with the horn. Actually, Miles' great band was but a preface to another awesome being, Trains, Coy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, Elvin Jones. But Train had to pass through the sphere of Thelonious to get deep into the mysterioso of the funk, leaving the world of the merely hip for the monkishly profound. Monk and Train at the Five Spot opens a new world of other than where you've been. Let me tell you, I was there. Train didn't even know the arrangements. He sounded like a stranger. But in a minute, Train was in it, and the whole building moved and pulled away. Little Rudy Tootie jackying in Monk's mood. So around midnight, the new music came. We never was the same. By the time they got from the Bowery to Carnegie Hall, must have been time for something next stop new. Even a Pharaoh, an Ornette, an Albert, a Sun Ra fell by. They heard Train's cry. Monk's blue inside. A new world welcomed those with ears to hear.
That was Amiri Baraka. And I play that interview about Malcolm X. But in the meantime, I'm going to play a couple of more pieces and get myself together here. This is our first show of the new year. I have been traveling in the African diaspora. This time I was in Salvador, Bahia, Brazil. Talk about walking in Africa with the ancestors. Oh, my goodness. Yes, it is a beautiful place. And yeah, very beautiful. I'll get a chance to tell you more about that. Yeah, if not this show, some other time. But I'm going to play a little bit about, something from Donald Duck Bailey, Fifth House. And Baba Baraka was 79 when he made his transition. And, oh, my goodness, didn't he leave us a wealth of wonderful, wonderful books, just fabulous books, and poetry and commentary and visual art. He was just a Renaissance man, and that whose impact we're not probably gonna really be able to comprehend immediately, because he was such an active artist. He was always producing and creating and changing things and inspiring us to think more about our lives and about the life that we create, the intentional life that we create, even unintentionally. So here is Donald Duck Bailey, Fifth House. one's entitled We Insist Freedom Now, Prayer, Protest, and Peace by Max Roach. And you heard Baba Baraka speak about Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, whom you hear, Abby Lincoln, on this particular classic piece.
Ooh.
Okay, that was Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, and I found the information about Amir Baraka. His birthday was October 7th. He was born in 1934, and he made his transition on January 9th, 2014. And I want to the wake and funeral services are, the wake is Friday, January 17th. 2014 from 4 to 9 p.m. at the Metropolitan Baptist Church, 149 Springfield Avenue, Newark, New Jersey. The phone number there, 07103, and the phone number is 973-642-2267. Again, that's the Metropolitan Baptist Church from 4 to 9 p.m. on Friday, January 17th. And funeral is, oh, and there's a website, MBC Newark, MBC Newark, as in Newark, New Jersey, .org. And the funeral is Saturday, January 18th at 10 a.m. at Newark Symphony Hall, 1020 Broad Street, Newark Symphony Hall, 1020 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 973-643-8014 is the phone number, and the website is newarksymphonyhall.org. And there's a poem. Mary Baraka was planning a tribute for his friend Jane Cortez, who made her transition last year, I believe, and when he became ill. And there's a poem that I received from through African Voices Communication dot Incorporated, there was, like, again, there was a tribute for him when he made 75. And Gael Rhodes Benjamin in King of the Word for Mary Baraka writes, "You is our poet laureate because nobody sliced through the BS like you do." In this email that I received is the rest of the poem. King of the Word for Amiri Baraka's 75th birthday. You was never ordinary, nor stationary, nor regular. You was always using your pen as sword, fighting, tearing down injustice in high and low places. You was never silent, but even when you wasn't saying a word, your words spoke endless decades of life and death on pages as permanent as the equations of brown-skinned mathematicians encoding sanctuaries of memories in our veins. Your words a drum, never losing tempo, escorting us beyond blabbering repertories of rhetoric. You is our poet laureate, 'cause can't nobody slice through the BS like you do. Uncensored, you stand with dignity straight from the gut. On your tongue, the melody of ancestral footsteps running in horrific discord. You say the words the deaf can hear. You speak the words that pierce a seeing man's eyes into blinding truths. You 75 now, they tell me, but what do that mean with a man moving full steam ahead up, down every avenue, all at once boiling, bleaching the lies out of history's elusive fabrications? For you even changed your name. It was your name waiting for the change that you came to become. You've been here always scripting out the next revolution, documenting how it went down for real. Judge a man by his deeds, the old folks say. Your deeds ain't nowhere near done, but one thing for sure, you was never ordinary. You was never hesitant, sitting, waiting for somebody else to say what needed to be said. You was always adding another word to even the score on the wall, and so it is written, you is king of word, 'cause can't nobody change a word you said. And again, that was 2009, Gael Rhodes Benjamin, Let Loose on the World Anthology. And I heard there was a really good of tribute to Baraka on Democracy Now. Haven't heard it yet because it happened when I was out of the country. But wanted to share that with you, and I'm going to play another song. And this one which one am I going to play now? I had it, and then I just moved it. Just a second. Play something from Umoja, which I thought would be really apropos. Oh, actually, I like Day Day Africa by Val Sarant. I'm going to play Day Day Africa. Actually, Africans and Americans is nice, too. I'm going to play Day Day Africa.
Yeah.
That was Val Sarant and others on D-Day Africa. And we are celebrating the life of poet, scholar, writer, activist, artist, Amiri Baraka, on the occasion of his transition. At 79, he is now with the ancestors, or he is making his ascension now. And we had him on the radio show May 18, 2011, celebrating the life of Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz. And it was on the occasion also of the publication of the long-awaited Manning Marable's reinvention of Elhaj Malik, or Malcolm X. And the book is still highly controversial. And wanted to have Amiri Baraka on the air to talk about sort of its implications and where Marable's scholarship, you know, sort of the roots of it, because it was quite the turn that that particular book took that we had been waiting for. And then he died. The author died right after he wrote it. So weren't able to actually query him on the book because he was no longer with us in this incarnation. So that particular day, it was I'm not sure if it was a Wednesday or Friday. I think it might have been a Friday show. I'm not sure. I don't remember what day the 18th fell on. But Malcolm X's birthday, of course, is May 19th. And so I think that might have been a Friday. And also on the air, we had friends and family who knew and admired Elhaj Malik. We had A. Peter Bailey, author, journalist, and friend of Brother Malcolm, and Yusufu Mosley, activist and practitioner of African Center Restorative Justice. Of course, as I mentioned already, we had Amiri Baraka on. And then that particular day, we closed with an interview with Abraham Burton, who headlined the 10th Annual Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival here in Oakland on that Saturday, May 21st at San Antonio Park, and they had a special concert that Sunday, the 22nd, which was outstanding. And Eastside Arts Alliance is a wonderful, wonderful space, community space, that if you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, you certainly need to check out, because they hosted Baba Baraka often, Elena and Greg and the other folks there at Eastside. Hosted him often, Fabiana Rodriguez, among others. I taught Baba Baraka's poem, Somebody Blew Up America, this past fall semester, 2013. I had students write about it, and quite a few of them had never heard of Baba Baraka, and that poem is classic, Somebody Blew Up America. And he asked the question, rhetorically, who could have done this? And if you don't know that poem, you definitely need to check it out. And when Baba Baraka was making a United States tour on the celebration of his 75th year, I was honored to be able to introduce him at a special program at the San Francisco Jazz Heritage Center, honoring his work and contribution to Black art, the Black Arts Movement, and that was hosted by Marvin X. And later on that evening, it was really great. Performed his poetry and prose with the Howard Wiley Trio, and that was just outstanding. And there was also a book that came out on the 75th anniversary year, sort of featuring the work of his friends and scholars and poets and folks that are just iconic, you know, Sonia Sanchez, Jane Cortez, oh my goodness, Haki Mabuti, Malcolm, Marvin X, oh my goodness, it's just a phenomenal collection of work, and I was able to see that because Marvin shared his with me, but it was just really just an honor to be able to introduce Amiri Baraka that afternoon at the Jazz Heritage Center. I never knew James Baldwin, but I can't think of a more brilliant mind until one thinks about Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, and his longevity. He was always there, whether that was honoring or commemorating the heroes at Attica Prison or attending readings at the Schomburg Center. He was the consummate public intellectual, and he got around. Literally, he traveled. I love his book, Digging, the Afro-American Soul of African, the Afro-American Soul of American Classical Music. I used the introduction in my freshman comp literature class when the book first came out, and I bought a copy and had it autographed for a friend of mine, Kamal Saitu, a musician and poet and writer. Before he passed, Amiri Baraka was in town, and I got the book and had it autographed and gave it to him while he was in the hospital. In Digging, Baraka writes about the Jolly or the Griot, and goes to great detail about that. And Jolly is a much better word to describe what black people do, particularly those that hold the heritage and tell the stories, which is what Amiri Baraka did. He was certainly a Jolly. His play, The Myth of Sisyphus, which was a musical collaboration with David Murray, also performed here in the Bay Area, was an allegory. What is the rock Black America keeps pushing up the incline only to have it roll back down? Is it justice? Is it equality? Is it freedom? I remember speaking to Baraka about the presidential candidate, Barack Obama, before he became our president. Had a chance to talk to him as he had lunch when he was in town producing the play with a local cast. And again, this was also performed at Eastside Arts Cultural Center. When I think about the beat poets, Amiri Baraka was one of two black poets I knew, the other, Bob Kaufman, who looked white. I didn't know he was black until, I don't know. It was a while later. Both had white wives. For Baraka, perhaps this was a phase. Both men produced phenomenal work, edgy and political. Both were race men. Baraka was a visual artist and a musician, too. He was a well-rounded human being. I remember not always agreeing with his Marxist critique or analysis of racism through class struggle lens, but he was Amiri Baraka, and I would be in the audience just because when Baraka spoke, you listened. I never imagined then that I'd get to know him and that he would read my column in the San Francisco Bay View with his wife, Amina, and then come on my radio show to talk about Malcolm X. I had many interviews with him, and he always asked me how I was doing and when I'd see him at events. I loved it when his wife, Amina, joined him or when one of his sons traveled with him. When he first started coming to San Francisco Bay Area for residencies, I always tried to attend the public programs. I thought he'd live forever. He will, of course. His body of work is vast and deep. I wish I could teach a class on him and his work. That would be so phenomenal. His writing or thinking process would be simply wonderful to study. I don't know who would take the class where I work, since students are not interested in intellectual rigor. But it would be so wonderful to honor his memory this way. We have so much to learn still from his walk. Yeah, his walk. His wonderful, wonderful walk. Oh, my goodness. The art exhibit at the African-American Art and Culture Complex that Greg curated, of Eastside Arts Cultural Center, was fantastic. And I believe Ishmael Reed did something with Amiri Baraka, maybe more than one or two things, but I remember that Ishmael Reed did something with him, and I know the homegoing is going to be outstanding, and I'm trying to make my way there. I'm going to see what I can do by getting a ticket to get to New York for the homegoing, because it's going to be fantastic. So without further ado, I've been promising to play this interview, and I have not done so yet, so I'm going to play this interview with Baba Baraka on Malcolm X. And again, it's from the archives on May 18th, and I might have had another interview with him, but I don't know for sure, when Abby Lincoln passed, and he was talking about the freedom freedom's sweet. And it was actually it was banned. It's like, wow, yeah, Max Roach's Freedom Now suite was banned. That was like really amazing. you know, we talk censorship in other countries. And Mary Baraka's, you know, Somebody Blew Up America was censored, and they and the state of New Jersey took back their poet laureate. They thought they took it back, but they can't take it back. Mary Baraka was certainly poet laureate of the United States of America. So anyway, here we are with this interview.
I know it was no accident.
Who do you believe is responsible for Malcolm X's
death? The white power structure in America is behind it. They're quick to capitalize on by saying that one of his own kind did it, but they put it up to do be done.
What do you mean, the white power structure?
The white power structure of America. They know they had more to gain by getting Malcolm X out of the way than they had to by letting him live. That's why.
But what is the white power structure?
Never mind. I just said the white power structure. You know the white race, don't you?
In the last year, like Roy Wilkins said, he changed. He wanted to get along with the white people. But you people didn't want to get along with.
What does Malcolm X's death mean to you? What do you feel about it?
What do you feel about it?
What do you feel about it?
It's a blow to have black people in the United States of America. Black.
It's what?
It's a blow, he said.
It's a blow.
He said it's a blow to every black American, black people in the United States. That's what he was saying.
Why is it a blow to you?
Because he's a part of me. Because he looks like me.
Stop
and his skin is me. He's a black man, and I'm a black man. And he takes up a black man's position.
That's right.
He was a hero to me. He stood out among all black people.
That's
he
right.
Showed the white man where it was at.
But why, right. Why was he a
he got
hero?
Respect. Why was he all fit in Princeton and all these big white universities? Because they respected him, too, the way I respected him.
That's
he meant
right.
Something to me. That's why I'm down here.
That's right.
Well, they killed Malcolm X. Well, they hadn't, like, killed him.
He
that's
was right.
Coming. He was for him.
Right.
And when you kill him, there's going to be more killing going on.
That's right.
And you're saying that you believe this was paid for by whites?
Yes, by white people. Because what would it benefit? What would it benefit one of us to kill him? It wouldn't benefit nothing. Wouldn't benefit us anything at all. Just a white power structure of this country. Anytime a black man in this country stands up for his constitutional rights, he dies. What does Malcolm X mean to you?
He meant a great deal to me and my people. I'm sorry that a good man is gone. At the first I hear of it, I couldn't have cried anymore, I don't believe, if I had lost my mother.
What did he mean to you? Can you tell me a bit more about it?
He meant deliverance for my people. And I hope we all walk in the same footsteps as Malcolm X was walking in.
I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution. There's a difference. When you study the historic nature of revolutions, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed.
Yes, that's right.
Number one, it was based on land. The basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution. What was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. and you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. So I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn-the-other-cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't use that word. A revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way.
This afternoon, we want to talk about...
That was Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, and we are honoring him on the eve of his birthday, May 19th. He was born in 1925, which means he will be held... Brother Bailey?
I think it's 86.
86, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the correct question would have been to ask, what did Malcolm's life mean to you as opposed to what did his death mean to you? So I'm going to introduce our guest, A. Peter Bailey, who is former editor of Ebony Magazine, and an original member of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, OAAU, founded in 1964 by Malcolm X. Brother Bailey was editor of the OAAU News Oregon Black Lash. He is also co-author of Revelations, the autobiography of Alvin Ailey, co-author with Rondell P. Collins, nephew of Malcolm X, the seventh child, a family memoir of Malcolm X. He assisted John Hendrick Clark with the editing of Malcolm X, The Man and His Times. As associate editor of the Black Theater Alliance, Brother Bailey edited the BTA newsletter. He's a native of Columbus, Georgia, and a graduate of Howard University. And we are speaking to him from the Bethune Du Bois Institute in Silver Spring, Maryland, thank you. What does MD stand for? So welcome. Thank you. Welcome. So happy you could join us. So tell us.
Good morning, Wanda.
What does... Oh, sorry, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask you, I interrupted you when you were going to say thank you, I think. I wanted to ask you, what did Malcolm X's life mean to you?
First, I'd just like to quickly say that I was not a graduate of Howard University. I attended Howard for 2 years, and I did my first political activism at Howard. But I dropped out after 2 years and got involved in the movement and ended up never going back. But someone told me that if you went there 2 years, then you're considered an alumni. But what he meant to me, he was, I usually refer to him as a master teacher. And to me, there is no more important member of a community than a master teacher. Brother Malcolm, basically, people such as myself, those of us who wanted to support him but who were not Muslims or were not prepared to become Muslims but who wanted to work with him, he gave us a perspective on the world, on how to view the world. He taught us. He taught us the importance of the use of words. He taught us such things as that in this country, we're not involved in a battle against individual whites here and there, but a system of white supremacy. He taught us about the psychological aspects of white supremacy and racism. See, most of the civil rights leaders of that time, they focused almost entirely on the physical manifestations of it. You know, the killings, the brutality, the firebombing, and these kinds of things. Brother Malcolm talked about that and also about the attack on our minds. Now, we know that because of the activities of the people in the 60s and things have happened since then, the physical manifestations have been reduced to a sizable degree, not eliminated, but reduced. The psychological manifestations are unrelenting and relentless, and they're constantly attacking our minds and our view of themselves. Brother Malcolm combated that. He taught us how to combat that, and he spoke about that on a regular, consistent basis. That's what he did for me. He basically gave me a worldview, a way to look at things, a way to interpret things, a way to analyze things, and how to be alert, especially against the constant psychological manifestations of white supremacy and racism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this book that that you edited, the collection of essays
by Malcolm X, A Man in His Times.
Yeah, that is so good. Yeah. Introduced by John Hendry Clark, and then he also introduces each session.
What happened there, Wanda, is that a brother named Earl Grant and I, Earl had been a very, see, I want to make it very clear, I was not a part of Brother Malcolm's inner circle. I was not a part of his inner circle. I was in the OEAU. I was the editor of the organization's newsletter. I don't like to try to make claims that they know that are just not the case. Earl Grant was a part of the inner circle.
Mm-hmm.
And after the assassination, Earl and I noticed that there were groups out there, everybody trying to claim Brother Malcolm and saying that he was with them on this issue and with them and utilizing his name. So we say, you know what we're going to do? Let's get put together a book of people who knew him personally and or politically and have them, you know, reflect on him from that perspective. And so Earl and I, we pulled together. We got this whole thing together. And, of course, in 1969, nobody knew either one of us, and we had no proud hard time getting any kind of body interested in terms of a publisher. So we then went to Dr. Clark and told him about our idea, and he got involved. And with him getting involved and having a name and a recognition, recognizable as a very prominent historian, he was able to help us get a publisher, and that's how that book came about. It was a reaction to, we were trying to keep people who were trying to, well, Brother Malcolm was joining my position, and he was coming to our position on this and our position on that. We were saying, no, we're not going to let that happen. We're going to find a way to stop that kind of thing, and that's how that book came about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have some really wonderful essays, sermons, and reflections, in the first part. And, I really like Myths About Malcolm X by Reverend Albert Cleach. That was like, wow.
Yes.
That was really good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Clark was the chief editor of the book. My main job was to do some of the research and put together an index of books. That had already been written, books and major books and articles had already been written about him. And Earl, of course, contributed an article that had never been published before.
That was really good.
I think that we did. I think we put a. Of course, we didn't put a stop to it, but we certainly, in putting that book out and getting out there, we kind of derailed some of those, you know, people who were trying to claim Brother Malcolm as their own, in a way that we thought was not reflecting what he was all about. And this happens constantly. Everybody tries to completely do away with Malcolm X, the black nationalist. I mean, that's been going on since they started writing about him. They always try to say he was no longer a black nationalist. Well, we deny that. He was a black nationalist when he died. He lived, he believed in the philosophy of black nationalism. And the reason that they try to say that he wasn't, that he had changed, was because they were given a wrong interpretation of black nationalism in the first place. They were making it sound as though black nationalists were some kind of, you know, ignorant people who thought that black people could function in the world all by themselves, that we didn't need nobody. Well, Brother Malcolm was too intelligent to have such a position. Black nationalists basically means that we looked upon ourselves as a nation within a nation, and we acted accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And we knew we had to work with other groups on different issues, and we were prepared to do that. And he was prepared to do that. But that does not mean that he was giving up his whole concept of black nationalism. There's a whole whites in this country, from left-wing whites to centrist whites to right-wing whites, and their black allies cannot absolutely stand the concept of black nationalism. They fight it on all of them reject it. And then the black folks who are allied with left-wing whites and centrist whites and right-wing whites, they also reject black nationalism. And the very fact of their reaction to it makes those of us who believe in it believe that it's the right way that we need to move as a people. Because if it wasn't, we don't believe there would be so much hostility towards the concept.
Right, yeah. Talk about, if you remember any particular parts of the book or any particular segments, particularly around the whole idea of black nationalism, because you cover quite a bit. You have a piece by Sister Betty. You've got a piece by Ossie Davis. I mean, this is really, really Gordon Parks. You've got Dialogues with Malcolm X, Part 3, where you you talk about the FBI, and the last part is Malcolm X Abroad. Are there any particular aspects of the book that, this many years later, that really sort of still resonate with you? Because one thing about
I think that Earl's piece, to me, I mean, being a journalist, you know, because there was just so much new information in that. In that piece, you know, so that really, you know, captured my and it stayed with me, as because it gave an idea of how the FBI operated, and some insights as to how, you know, their whole attempts to discredit or to claim or bribe people, you know, it really gave some insights as to how the FBI operates. So I found that piece, when I first read it, incredibly informative and educational, and even today, you know, I still consider it very valuable. I think that all the pieces in there are written, as I said before, we wanted people who knew him personally and or politically. And I think that book, to me, really gave the kind of like before anybody else gave the first insights as to how he was respected by people across a wide variety of ideological beliefs. He was respected. I'm not going to say he was loved by many of these people, but he was respected by them. And you can see that in the contributions in that book. That's why I think that book, even today, is still very valuable for anyone who's writing anything about him. And I'm proud to have been, a part of that, of that effort.
Yeah. I was thinking I could play a piece where Malcolm X talks about our roots in Africa. It says that you can't hate the roots of a tree. It's a really short piece. I'm sure people might be familiar with it. I'm going to play that now.
Okay.
Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And then naturally it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who have been thoroughly brainwashed, who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a negative attitude toward yourself, a positive attitude toward yourself, and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of, an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully made you and me hate our African identity, our African characteristics. And you know yourself. And we have been a people who hated our African characteristics. We hated our hair. We hated the shape of our nose. We wanted one of those long, dog-like noses, you know. Yeah. We hated the color of our skin. Hated the blood of Africa that was in our veins. And in hating our features and our skin and our blood, why, we had to end up hating ourselves. And we hated ourselves. Our color became to us a chain. We felt that it was holding us back. Our color became to us like a prison, which we felt was keeping us confined, not letting us go this way or that way. And we felt that all of these restrictions were based solely upon our color, and the psychological reaction to that would have to be that as long as we felt imprisoned or chained or trapped by black skin, black features, and black blood, that skin and those features and that blood that was holding us back automatically had to become hateful to us. And it became hateful to us. It made us feel inferior. It made us feel inadequate. It made us feel helpless. And when we fell victim to this feeling of inadequacy or inferiority or helplessness, we turned to somebody else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in another black man to show us the way, or black people to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't think a black man could do anything but play some horn, you know, some sound, and make you happy with some songs, and in that way. But when an inferior thing, where our food, clothing, and shelter was concerned, and our education was concerned, we turned to the man. We never thought in terms of bringing these things into existence for ourselves. We never thought in terms of doing things for ourselves, because we felt helpless. And what made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves. One of the things that made the black Muslim movement grow was its emphasis upon things African. This was the secret to the growth of the black Muslim movement. African blood, African origin, African culture, African ties. And you'd be surprised. We discovered that deep within the subconscious of the black man in this country, he's still more African than he is American. He thinks that he's more American than African because the man is jiving him and the man is brainwashing him every day, telling him, you're an American. Man, how could you think you're an American and you have never had any kind of American treat over here? You have never, never. 10 men can be sitting at a table eating, you know, dining. And I can come and sit down where they're dining. They're dining. I got a plate in front of me, but nothing is on it. Because all of us sitting at the same table are all of us diners. I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. Just being at the table with others who are dining doesn't make me a diner. And this is what you got to get in your head here in this country. Just because you're in this country doesn't make you an American. And no, you got to go farther than that before you can become an American. You got to enjoy the fruits of Americanism. And you haven't enjoyed those fruits. You've enjoyed the thorns. You've enjoyed the thistles. But you have not enjoyed the fruits. No, sir. So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance in 1965 of being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. I say that again, that I'm not a racist. I don't believe in any form of segregation or anything like that. I'm for the brotherhood of everybody, but I don't believe in enforcing brotherhood upon people who don't want it. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, and then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we practice it with them also, we're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us. Thank you.
Wanda.
Wanda, do you want you to share perhaps some reflections I believe you would say your friend, Hajj Maligo Shabazz, and what it was like being
what I will say to you now is what you just played is an absolutely quintessential example of Malcolm X, the master teacher.
Uh-huh.
He was teaching. He was teaching. And he was a teaching, and he was doing the other things that I had talked about before. He was talking about the psychological effects of white supremacy / racism. So he was teaching. That was a classic example of Malcolm X, the master teacher, in action. And he spoke like that time after time after time. That's what I learned. I remember, I'm old enough to remember going to movies in Tuskegee, Alabama, which was my home, and sitting in segregated movie theaters, a whole movie theater full of black kids between the ages of about 8 and 12. And we were sitting in those movie theaters Saturday after Saturday, cheering Tarzan and his chimpanzee, Cheetah, as they beat up on 40 or 50 African warriors. I remember that. The image of Africa that was presented to us when I was a child. I'm old enough to remember that. And that's what Brother Malcolm was talking about, the psychological aspects of white people. And what you just played, for everybody who listened, that was a – and now nowadays that may not sound so much, but back in the 60s when he was saying that, that was almost – that was – ideologically, that was revolutionary. Because at that time, many black people still had this very negative attitude towards Africa. Some of them still have it today. So that was Malcolm X, the master teacher in action. That's what I meant. That's what I remember about him. That's what I learned from him. I learned, and his talking about Africa was not just based on some kind of emotional, romantic thing. His position that he gave me in an article the day before he was assassinated was that we needed to have contact with Africa because a strong Africa would be an umbrella of support for people of African descent, no matter where they were in the world. And he used the example of China. He said, when I was growing up, people used to say, you don't have a Chinaman's chance, which means that your chance of doing something was nil. He said, they don't say that no more. Why they don't say it no more? Because China is now a force on the world scene. So a strong China provides an umbrella of protection for people of Chinese descent all over the world. And he was saying that that's the same position that Africa should have for people of African descent. So it was not just an emotional, psychological connection that he was talking about. He was talking about something very practical. That's Malcolm X, the master teacher. You picked a classic example of it. And I like to also respond to the first speech that you did when he sounded so angry.
Yeah. Right.
People have to understand that between 1955 and 1965, when Brother Malcolm was on the scene, that was rampant terrorism going on in this country. And I'm using that word, terrorism, was going on in this country. People were being lynched. People were being run out of their homes. They were losing their jobs. That was the height of the civil rights movement. And you can just list names of people who were killed just because they were involved in the civil rights movement by white supremacists and racists. And brother, so, and this was after the bombing of those little girls. So if he sounded angry, he should sound angry. People listen to that speech now and they say, man, he sounds so hard. Why was he so angry? He was angry because there was rampant terrorism going on in this country between 1955 and 1965, and nobody was being punished for it. That's what I always tell people when they say how angry he was. He had a right to be angry. A church had been firebombed and killed four little black girls.
When you visited us a while back to see your good friend Yuri Koshiyama, whose birthday mm-hmm. is also May 19th. I think she's like a year or two older than Malik al-Shabazz, and she was a good friend of his, and he wrote her and visited her at her home. You spoke about how Haj Malik was always reading and studying, and he took time out, you know, to speak to individuals, you know, like yourself, and, you know, give mm-hmm. you some, like, real, you know, one-on-one quality time.
Yeah, he was constantly.
Talk about. Yeah, uh-huh.
He was constantly, I mean, like any truly intelligent person, he was constantly learning. Mm-hmm. He was a great listener. One of the most important things to be a great leader, you have to also be a great listener. And Brother Malcolm was a great listener. When be a group of people and people are talking, and he, you could almost see, you could see him listening to what was being said. You know, and that's another mark of a truly great leader. And I tell young people, sometimes I teach as an adjunct professor at the University of District of Columbia, and I tell my students, man, one of the most important things that you must learn is to be a listener. You have to know how to listen to what is going on. And Brother Malcolm was a master of that. And that's another reason why he was able to accomplish the things that he did. And that's another thing I remember about him. He was a courteous person. He was one of the most courteous people I've ever met in my life. He was very considerate of people. He was very, very, very concerned. And, you know, he was courteous, the old-fashioned courtesy when he spoke with you or when he dealt with you. And that was, you know, those are things, you know, that I remember about him from a personal level. I had the opportunity sometimes being in a situation where it might be him and myself and maybe four or five other people, so it was like a small setting, and where you could really see him, you know, interact with people and talk and laugh and joke, you know, and that kind of thing. I had at least maybe three times when I had that honor, and so you see him in another light than when you see him speaking to a large crowd, you know, at a rally or something.
And you edited the newspaper for the OAAU. Talk about that, and also talk about, you know, your colleagues, the people around you, and some of your interaction. And
It was really not a newspaper; it was a newsletter. And when the OAAU was being formed, and people were taking various positions to do things in the organization, you know, we had different committees, a cultural committee, a youth committee, an economic development committee, an education committee, et cetera. Nobody volunteered to do the newsletter, so I volunteered to do it. At that time, I haven't had no journalism at all, but I volunteered to do the newsletter, and that's how I became the editor of the newsletter. We put out 9 issues. We reported on his trips abroad when nobody else was doing so. I have copies of all 9 issues. The first 3 issues we was referred to as the OAAU newsletter. Beginning with the 4th issue, we called it the Blacklash. And we did that because there was a lot of talk at the time about the white backlash against progress that black people were making. So we decided to call the newsletter the Blacklash. That's how it got that name. But we had photos. I mean, we did a good job considering that we were working with, you know, the old-fashioned mimeograph machine. We had to turn the wheel, turn the handle to, you know, to make copies and everything. But eventually Brother Malcolm told me, in fact, the day of the assassination, he told me that he was going to turn the newsletter one of his plans was to turn the newsletter into a tabloid-sized newspaper. You know, as for my colleagues, man, some of the most committed, dedicated, intelligent, and brilliant people that I ever met were people that I met when I was during those 14 months with the OAAU. I mean, the people who headed the Culture Committee and the Education Committee and the Youth Committee and the Economic. I mean, these were serious brothers and sisters who had, you know, who had skills and talent, who probably could have been out doing anything, but they were committed to what was going on. So we had a real cadre of top quality people involved with the OAAU. And I think, you know, the forces who operated around here knew that. The forces who were hostile to Brother Malcolm knew that. That he was attracting, he had that ability. Because people always try to make it sound as though the only people who listened to Brother Malcolm were the quote-unquote street folks, you know, the homeboys and the homegirls from the streets. Well, that's simply not true. They listened, but there were also a whole lot of other folks, you know, who listened to him and who were prepared to work with him for the advancement, you know, of our people. And I saw those people in the OAAU.
Mm-hmm.
Most
right.
I would say that 90% of the OAAU members were not Muslims. Because he had set up a separate organization called Muslim Mosque Incorporated for those people, you know, who were supporting him from a religious perspective. But the OAAU people were those of us who wanted to work with him but who were not prepared to become Muslims. Some of them were strong. Some of them were very strong Christians, but they still believed in what he was doing from a political, economic, cultural perspective and wanted to work with him. So he had the ability to attract a variety of people.
Yeah. So when you started working with Brother Malcolm, you started working with him when he had established the organization of Afro-American Unity, or had you been working with him prior to that? Did you come in at that
time? I had been following him since 1962 was when I first heard him speak. So I became a follower then, but I could not work with him because I was not prepared to become a member of the Nation of Islam. When the OAAU was founded, I was a founding member. I went to the meetings where there was discussion about the organization beginning in January 1964. We used to meet and start organizing the OAAU. It was announced publicly in June of 1964. But we had been meeting since January, you know, preparing for that public announcement of the organization. So I was there, you know, at the beginning when it was being, you know, structured.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So you were following him when he went on his pilgrimage to Mecca to the Hajj, and you were following him when he went to the Organization of African Unity session.
Yes.
I believe that was in Egypt, right?
Cairo, 1964.
Yeah,
from 1962.
Exactly.
From 1962, mm-hmm. when I first heard him speak, until this day, I've been a Malcolmite. From the first time I heard him speak in June 1962 until right now when we're talking, I have been a Malcolmite. And I was there during that stretch when he was in Cairo, you know, in 1964. I remember that was an important event because it was the first time that an African American had been invited to be an observer at a meeting of African heads of state, not a participant, but an observer. He had been invited to be there as an observer, and he used that opportunity to push his campaign. He had a plan of having the United States government taken before the UN Commission on Human Rights for, quote-unquote, being either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of black people in this country. Again, I have to remind the audience of what was going on during that time. It was a time of intense brutality. Terrorism was rampant throughout the South in this country during that time. And so he was going to, and the government was claiming that it couldn't do anything because it was the state's problem. So he was planning on developing, and when he went to the OAU meeting in Cairo, he began to lay the foundation for this appeal of taking going before the UN Commission on Human Rights, which is why the OEAU, we called ourselves a human rights organization, not a civil rights organization, because human rights is the international term.
Right. So when you were at the meetings establishing the Organization of Afro-American Unity, how did you all negotiate the structure of the organization in the diaspora? Because clearly it was inspired by the OAU.
Yes, that's how the name came about.
Right.
That's why Brother Malcolm selected that name. The Organization of African Unity, the Organization of Afro-American Unity.
Right.
So at the very first meeting, he told us that was, you know, that was what he wanted to call the organization.
So with regards to for our audience that might not be aware of the principles and the philosophy behind the OAU and the OAAU, I was wondering, were there parallels? I'm sure there are parallels besides the name. So I was wondering if you could maybe talk about.
It was an attempt. It was just as the OAU was an attempt to bring the African countries together so they could act in some kind of unified manner, you know, in dealing with other people. The OAU had the same purpose. It was an effort to bring in African American people from all different kinds of religions and beliefs and that kind of thing, bring them together in an organization where we could work together to advance our interests in this, you know, in this country and in this world. That was the purpose. That's why it had that name, and Brother Malcolm was, you know, he had reached out to some of the other civil rights leaders to, you know, to try to get them to understand that's what he was trying to do, you know, but that was the purpose, to try to bring together, and within the OAU itself, we had that kind of variety, and I definitely believe that had he not been assassinated, we would have grown. That organization would have grown to become a very, very major contributor to the progress of our people in this country and in the world.
Mm-hmm. Right. Look, right now on the continent, this past year was the the third edition of the World Festival of Black Art and Culture, and one of the themes that President of Senegal, you know, spoke of over and over again was the United States of Africa, and that seems right in keeping with the message that El Hadj Malik pushed, was like, you know, unification.
Yes.
And unity.
Yes, he was a strong believer in the concept of Africa. He believed that he was what we call a pan-Africanist. He believed that there should be some kind of unified working together, a unified promoting our interests of people of African descent, no matter where they were in the world. That includes South America, Europe, the Caribbean, and on the continent. He just believed that people of African descent throughout the world, we would advance and protect our interests much more effectively if we had some kind of, you know, unified working. Does that mean that everybody's going to be exactly the same? No. But it meant that we would look upon ourselves as a unit, as pan-Africanists, so that anything that affected people of African descent, no matter where they were in the world, we had a stake in taking care of that, just like the Chinese do with the Chinese people, just like the Jewish people do with Jewish people. If you mess with Jewish people anywhere in the world, they affect the Jewish community based out of Israel is ready to confront you. I don't care where it is. Well, we wanted the same thing with people of African descent and the same thing that the Chinese provides for people of Chinese descent.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I hear it a bit, but how much longer do we have?
We have another. More 15 minutes.
Okay. Are you going to play another tape?
I could.
Okay. Because I tell you why. Because I'm sitting at my. I'm at my office, and I'm sitting at my receptionist desk, and I gotta move to my desk so she can have her dance.
Sure.
So I would say when you play another tape, then I can go.
Yeah, I'll play.
I can put it on hold and go to, you know, go to my desk.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll play the speech that Haj Malik made when in Detroit after his house was bombed.
Okay, and then I'll go to my desk and then I'll pick from there. Okay.
Okay. All righty.
Distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and enemies. I want to point out first that I'm very happy to be here this evening, and I'm thankful for the invitation to come here to Detroit this evening. I was in a house last night that was bombed, my own, but it didn't destroy all my clothes at all, but you know what happens when fire dashes through. They get smoky. The only thing I could get my hands on before leaving was what I have on now. And it isn't something that made me lose confidence in what I'm doing, because my wife understands, and I have children from this size on down, and even in their young age, they understand. I think they would rather have a father or a brother or whatever the situation may be who will take a stand in the face of any kind of reaction from narrow-minded people, rather than to compromise and later on have to grow up in shame and in disgrace. So I just ask you to excuse my appearance. I don't normally come out in front of people without a shirt and a tie. I guess that's somewhat a holdover from the Black Muslim movement, which I was in, and that's one of the good aspects of that movement. It teaches you to be very careful and conscious of how you look, which is a positive contribution on their part. But that positive contribution on their part is greatly offset by too many other liabilities. Before I get involved in anything nowadays, I have to straighten out my own position, and which is clear, I am not a racist in any form whatsoever. I don't believe in any form of racism. I don't believe in any form of discrimination or segregation. I believe in Islam. I'm a Muslim. And there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. Nothing wrong with the religion of Islam. That just teaches us to believe in Allah as the God. And those of you who are Christians probably believe in the same God. Because I think you believe in the God who created the universe. And that's the one we believe in, the one who created the universe. The only difference being, you call him God, and we call him Allah. Jews call him Jehovah. If you could understand Hebrew, you'd probably call him Jehovah too. If you can understand Arabic, you'd probably call him Allah. But since the white man, your friend, took your language away from you during slavery, the only language you know is his language, you know, your friend's language. So you call him, you call for the same God he calls for. When he's putting a rope around your neck, you call for God, he calls for God. And you wonder why the one you call on never answers you. When I was in the Black Muslim movement, they didn't have the real religion of Islam in that movement. It was something else. But the real religion of Islam doesn't teach anyone to judge another human being by the color of his skin. The yardstick that is used by the Muslim to measure another man is not the man's color, but the man's deeds, the man's conscious behavior, the man's intention. And when you use that as a standard of measurement or judgment, you never go wrong. But when you just judge a man because of the color of his skin, then you're committing a crime, because that's the worst kind of judgment. If you judge him just because he was a Jew, that's not as bad as judging him because he's black. Because a Jew can hide his religion. He can say he's something else, and which a lot of them do that. They say they're something else. But a black man can't hide. When they start indicting us because of our color, that means we're indicted before we're born, which is the worst kind of crime that can be committed. Elijah Muhammad had taught us that the white man could not enter into Mecca in Arabia, and all of us who followed him, we believed it. And he said the reason he couldn't enter was because he's white and inherently evil. It's impossible to change him. And the only thing that would change him is Islam, and he can't accept Islam because by nature he's evil. And therefore, by not being able to accept Islam and become a Muslim, he could never enter Mecca. And this is how he taught us. And, you know, and so when I got over there and went to Mecca and saw these people who blind and blue-eyed and pale skin and all those things, I said, well, but I watched them closely, and I noticed that there was, though they were white, and they would call themselves white, there was a difference between them and the white one over here. And that basic difference was this. In Asia or the Arab world or in Africa, where the Muslims are, if you find one who says he's white, all he's doing is using an adjective to describe something that's incidental about him, one of his incidental characteristics. So there's nothing else to it. He's just white. But when you get the white man over here in America and he says he's white, he means something else. You can listen to the sound of his voice when he says he's white. He means he's boss. That's right. That's what white means in this language. You know the expression free, white, and 21. He made that up. He's letting you know all of them mean the same. White means free, boss. He's up there. So that when he says he's white, he has a little different sound in his voice. And I know you know what I'm talking about. Despite the fact that I saw that Islam was a religion of brotherhood, I also had to face reality. And when I get back into this American society, I'm not in a society that practices brotherhood. I'm in a society that might preach it on Sunday, but they don't practice it on no day, on any day. And so since I could see that America itself is a society where there is no brotherhood, and that this society is controlled primarily by racists and segregationists, and it is, this is a society whose government doesn't hesitate to inflict the most brutal form of punishment and oppression upon dark-skinned people all over the world. To wit, right now, what's going on in and around Saigon and Hanoi and in the Congo and in elsewhere. They are violent when their interests are at stake. But with all of that violence that they display at the international level, when you and I want just a little bit of freedom, we're supposed to be nonviolent. They're violent. They're violent in Korea. They're violent in Germany. They're violent in the South Pacific. They're violent in Cuba. They're violent wherever they go. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be nonviolent. We should defend ourselves. And when I say that we should defend ourselves against the violence of others, they use their press skillfully to make the world think that I'm calling on violent spirit. And I wouldn't call on anybody to be violent without a cause. But I think the black man in this country, above and beyond people all over the world, will be more justified when he stands up and starts to protect himself, no matter how many necks he has to break and heads he has to crack. I saw in the paper where on the television where they took this black woman down in Selma, Alabama, and knocked her right down on the ground, dragging her down the street. You saw it. You're trying to pretend like you didn't see it because you knew you should have done something about it and didn't. It showed the sheriff and his henchmen throwing this black woman on the ground. On the ground. And Negro men standing around doing nothing about it, saying, well, let's overcome them with our capacity to love. What kind of phrase is that? Overcome them with our capacity to love. And then it disgraces the rest of us because all over the world the picture is flashed showing a black woman with some white groups with their knees on her holding her down and black, full-grown black men standing around watching it. Why, you are lucky to let you stay on earth, much less stay in the country. When I saw it, I dispatched a wire to Rockwell. Rockwell was one of the agitators down there. Rockwell, this Lincoln Rockwell. And the wire said, in essence, that this is to warn him that I am no longer held in check from fighting white supremacists by Elijah Muhammad's separatist black Muslim movement, and that if Rockwell's presence in Alabama causes harm to come to Dr. King or any other black person in Alabama who is doing nothing other than trying to enjoy their rights, then Rockwell and his Ku Klux Klan friends would be met with maximum retaliation from those of us who are not handcuffed by this nonviolent philosophy. And I haven't heard from Rockwell since. And brothers and sisters, if you and I would just realize that once we learn to talk the language that they understand, they will then get the point. You can't ever reach a man if you don't speak his language. If a man speaks the language of brute force, you can't come to him with peace. Why, good night. He'll break you in two, as he has been doing all along. If a man speaks French, you can't speak to him in German. If he speaks Swahili, you can't communicate with him in Chinese. You have to find out, what does this man speak? And once you know his language, you learn how to speak his language. And he'll get the point. There'll be some dialogue, some communication, and some understanding will be developed. And you've been in this country long enough to know the language the Klan speaks. They only know one language. And what you and I have to start doing in 1965, I mean, that's what you have to do, because most of us already been doing it, is start learning a new language. Learn the language that they understand. And then when they come up on our doorstep to talk, we can talk. And they will get the point. There'll be a dialogue. There'll be some communication. And I'm quite certain there will then be some understanding. Why? Because the Klan is a cowardly outfit. They have perfected the art of making Negroes be afraid. And as long as the Negroes are afraid, the Klan is safe. But the Klan itself is coward. And they never come, one of them never come after one of you. They all come together. And they're scared of you. And you sit there when they put the rope around your neck saying, forgive them, Lord, they know not what they do. As long as they've been doing it, they're experts at it. They know what they're doing.
Okay. Brother Peter, are you back?
Yes. Another classic example of the master teacher. Now, mm-hmm. I think when you listen to him, you can see why I use that term. He was a master teacher. And he knew the analogy. He was a communicator. He knew how he could speak to PhDs at Harvard or Oxford or Howard. But he could also speak the language that could be understood by folks, you know, just regular folks. When he used those analogies and those anecdotes, they knew exactly what he was talking about. That's the ability of a great leader, that he can't just speak to one group of people. He can speak to a whole wide spectrum. He can communicate with people. You know, oh, man, when I listen to that stuff, man, I just be saying to myself, that's a master teacher in action.
I wanted to ask you about the seventh child, the book that you co-authored with Bahaj Malik El Shabazz's nephew,
Rodnell Collins.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he writes in this book about how his mother, his uncle's, really close aunt, whom he stayed with for a bit when he was a child and would visit often, she started writing this book. She started, I think, like it was over 20 years. It was like her life's work that he picked up when she was no longer able to continue.
Yeah, well, the book, Seventh Child, A Family Memoir of Malcolm X, is basically the memoir of Sister Ella Collins, who was the sister that Brother Malcolm was to live with when I think he was 14 years old, when she brought him to Boston to live with her. The book is basically her memoirs as told to her son, Rodnell Collins. they brought me in on it to help them because I, you know, I was a journalist and a writer, and they neither one of them were, so they brought me in to kind of help, you know, write, get the book organized and structured in a way. But it's there, it's her memoirs as reflected, you know, as she told to her son Rodnell, who was Brother Malcolm's nephew. And of course, Sister Ella, one thing I found out in working on that book and in reading letters between them and things of that type, that she was one of his major confidants. In fact, one of the things I found fascinating about working on that project is that you actually can see Brother Malcolm seeking advice and information and kind of sympathy from his big sister. She was the older. She was the big sister. And he was the little brother talking to his big sister. You can see that in some of the, you know, in some of their correspondence with each other. It was fascinating because it provided another very kind of human look at him. You know, it's not mm-hmm. just the great leader and the great communicator and debater and thinker and intellectual, but also, hey, I need to get some advice from my big sister. And she played that role for him.
Right, yeah. And just in the part of the book that I read, because I didn't finish it, however, I do recommend it, that it be, you know, on the list of those who want to find out more about, you know, Brother Malcolm's life, certainly, I certainly recommend this book. When she was talking about how when Mother was institutionalized for mental illness, and I didn't realize she had been there for so long, and she talked about her siblings and how there was a split in the family, how they didn't want to let their little brother be a part of the family. So you could talk about that, because that
What it was that Sister Ella and Brother Malcolm had the same father, who was Earl Little Sr. Earl Little Sr.'s first wife was named Daisy Mason down in Georgia, where they were born, the Little family. One of the things I'd been working on that book, I had an opportunity to go down to these two counties down in rural Georgia and actually meet members of the Little family who are connected with him. And I even went to a Little family reunion. But Earl Sr. was married to Daisy Mason, and they split. They had three children, Sister Ella, Mary, and Earl Jr. And then the two of them split up, and Earl Sr. left Georgia and came north. And it was there while he was up, I think, up in Montreal, where he met the woman who became Brother Malcolm's mother. And of course, there was this thing between, you know, the Mason family, which was, you know, his first wife's family, and Earl Little. They were, you know, they were kind of resentful of the way that the first marriage ended. And so when Sister Ella, when Earl Sr. was killed by white supremacists in Michigan, and I think it was in Lansing, I think it would happen. Sister Ella, you know, had contact with her half brothers and sisters, and she said she wanted to bring all of them to Boston, but her mother and her aunt, who was still very resentful of the father, wouldn't allow her to do it. But she finally convinced them to let her bring Brother Malcolm, and that's how he got to Boston to live with her. According to what she said and what Rodnell and we said in the book, she wanted to bring all the Brother Malcolm's siblings to Boston to live with her. But her mother and her aunt, who, again, because of their hostility toward Earl Sr., would not allow that to happen. So she ended up just being able to bring Brother Malcolm. And she had to really, because they were all living together.
Mm-hmm.
She had to work hard to get, you know, to convince them to let her bring him.
Right, yeah. And in the book, one thing in the part that I finished was about how the whole thing was about the family and keeping the family together, and his aunt Ella was, you know, she really felt really strongly about that, as did Elhaj Malik, and he was really happy when he was able to finally bring his mother back to the family. And wish you could talk about sort of how the system split up his family, and he ended up taking them from his mother just by bothering them, you know,
Sister Ella,
with all these children. Hmm? Go ahead.
According to what we did, I learned where on the seventh child, the family memoir of Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
when Earl Sr. died, when Earl Sr. not, he didn't die, he was killed.
Killed. Yeah.
When he was killed, of course, the nobody would help Brother Malcolm's mother. Nobody, the black folks were afraid to help them because they were Garveyites. Brother Malcolm's parents were Garveyites, strong Garveyites. In fact, his mother was the correspondent for the Garveyites in newspaper. They were strong Garveyites. This scared the other black folks because they felt as though with them being strong Garveyites, that was going to bring the white folks down on the whole black community because of them. So when he was killed, the black community would have nothing to do with them, and of course the white community had nothing to do with them. So she was in a bind. She had, I think, six children. She was in a real bind, and basically, she had a, according to Sister Ella, she had a nervous breakdown. Mm-hmm. And when she had a nervous breakdown, Sister Ella's position was, and I don't know, again, this is just what she believed, was that she finally decided that, you know, these people are not going to help me and my children. So the only way that I'm going to get help from my children is if they think that I am kind of out of it. So she kind of, even after she recovered, she kind of played this out of it thing so the system or some kind of way would help her children because she was no longer in a position to help them. And then that's what happened there. Now, that was what I got from working on Sabbath Child with Sister Ella. I have not talked to, had not a chance to talk to any of their siblings to find out about how that went, but that was what she did, which to me made a little bit of sense. But because when he was, as I said earlier, when Earl Sr. was killed by the racists, both the black community were afraid to be connected with her, and the white community, of course, was hostile because of their connections with Garvey. They were throwing Garvey at, and that was a big Ku Klux Klan contingent in those, you know, in those places at that time. You know, so it was a situation again. And so when I hear people again talk about, oh, his speeches were so harsh and he was this and he was, you have to understand the times in which Brother Malcolm was there. What happened as a child? What happened when he was an adult? All the things that were going on, the lynchings, the killings, the brutality, the denial of basic human rights. This stuff was not somebody making it up. This was happening. I just went back and looked at that list between 1955 and 1965, when he was active on the scene. 24 people were lynched, and nobody was punished for it. Although they knew who had done it, in 99% of those cases, they knew exactly who had done it, but nobody was punished. So when you hear Brother Malcolm's speeches, he was responding to that atmosphere. And we're not even talking about the people who were just brutalized, whose homes were firebombed, who were run out of town, their jobs, who lost their property, whose children were put down with fire hoses and police dogs in Birmingham and places like that. I mean, you cannot understand what Brother Malcolm was saying and what he was all about and what was, unless you know the times in which he was operating. That was terrorism, I repeat, that was rampant terrorism going on in this country, and nobody was being published for it. And Brother Malcolm, as he said, he advocated self-defense. When I go out and speak at colleges, and I've spoken at about 35 colleges across the country, they always raise this. Why did he sound so harsh? And I tell them that. And I said, and by the way, if anybody can come across a statement where Brother Malcolm said that black people should go out and just start killing white people, I'll give you $100. I haven't had to pay yet. Because you can't find, you're not going to find nothing like that. He talked about self-defense, that black people had a right to defend themselves from the terrorists who were running rampant, and especially in the South during that time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. You're at the Bethune-Du Bois Institute. What is the Bethune-Du Bois
Institute? It's an education-focused organization founded by Dr. C. Dolores Tucker. And we have provided scholarship assistance to students to purchase textbooks. People don't understand how extremely expensive textbooks are. And sometimes students get to college, they get a scholarship or something to college, and then can't afford the textbooks. So we have provided textbook purchase assistance scholarships to students who are going into college, freshmen. We published a journal called Vital Issues, the Journal of African American Speeches, presents speeches. It's like a black equivalent of Vital Speeches. And we also conduct public issues forums on critical issues confronting black folks in this country. Those are the kind of things that we do as an organization. And I'm the communications consultant with the organization and the editor of the journal. And by the way, I want to leave a telephone number for anyone wanting to contact me. Would be 202-716-4560. That's 202-716-4560.
Do you want to leave an email address as well?
I don't want to leave because I have an email on my job, and I'm hopefully in the next 3 months or so I will know how to use this new stuff, and I'll be able to do it. But I don't want to, because the young lady, she has to work for the office, and she can't be dealing with a lot of my emails coming in, because I don't know how to pull them myself. So I don't leave an email address. I left a cell phone number.
Okay, so that's 202-716-4560.
60, yes.
Okay, well, super. Well, it's been really wonderful talking to you this morning, reminiscing on Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz and his great work and his messages, which are still pertinent today. And perhaps we could have you on again with Ronell Collins to talk about The Seventh Child, the family memoir.
And thank you again for celebrating his birthday like this. It's tomorrow. Birthday would have been 86 years old. And thank you again for providing me with an opportunity to show people what I mean when I say that he was a master teacher. And there's no more important member of any community than a master teacher.
Right, yeah. Well, thank you again.
Okay, thank you.
You take good care. Peace and blessings.
Mm-hmm. Same to you.
Bye-bye. So we're going to play a piece by Khalil El-Zabar and Archie Shepp called Brother Malcolm.
Brother Malcolm, 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 Brother Malcolm. Brother Malcolm, 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 Brother Malc
Again, that was Brother Malcolm, Michael Hill, El Zabar, and Archie Shepp. And we are joined in the studio by Yusufu Mosley, who is going to talk to us about this book, which was released April 4th, I believe, by Manny Marble, who passed away early April. And the book has been reviewed quite widely with varying commentary, and we want to talk about it. Yusufu holds 2 degrees, a BA in sociology and an MA in political science with an emphasis on social ethics. He is also a longtime community activist, and his work with various community organizations is designed to advance the liberation struggle. Currently, Yusufu works in the social justice field and is a member of several professional organizations related to the criminal justice field in the Chicagoland area. Yusufu is a trained and certified as a circle keeper in restorative justice field. He has completed 80 hours of restorative justice sponsored by the Community Justice Institute and Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention of Florida Atlantic University, 16 hours of training for community panels for youth at the Children and Family Justice Center of the Northwestern University School of Law, and 120 hours of peacemaking circles for the Living Justice Institute of St. Paul, Minnesota, and the Center for Reconciliation in Chicago, Illinois. And we have him joining us because he is a Malcolm X scholar. And, I mean, if it's been written, if it's been shown in a film, even notes and letters, if they're published, he has read it or watched it or listen to it. So we're definitely going to have you on again, Brother Yusufu, since, you know, we sort of have some technical difficulties, and we're not going to be able to have you for a full half an hour. It's like, man, I was cutting it short. So let me let you just dive in and talk about this work. Give us the full title of the book, and just talk about Alhaj Malik and what he means to you, because you are certainly, you might not have known the brother personally, but you are certainly, you know, one of his followers and one of the people that take his work to heart.
Well, thank you for all of that, and good morning, and I apologize for being so late. Well, I don't know where to be. I do know where to begin. One of the things that I want to begin with is Malcolm said in the Marble Book that the devil's strongest weapon is his ability to conventionalize our thought. And I think that that's a key piece, because that's what this book is trying to do, conventionalize or make current our thought rather than deal with the historical person that we know as Malcolm X. And it's sad, because I think I mentioned to you that I had email exchanges with Manny Marble, and I wanted to know why he chose the title Reinvention, because I thought it was such a undercutting kind of term or label to put on such a brother who gave his life for our struggle and our people. And I was wondering about that, and then I read the book, and I was gravely set back, I'll say. I won't say disappointed, because I know he spent a lot of years. I knew 5 years after he began the project, I was aware of it. And I found his email, got it, tried to stay in touch and that kind of thing. And he wrote me maybe 2 weeks before his transition, and then the book came out, explaining to me why he chose reinvention. And by way of conclusion, I would say this is a reinvention of Malcolm, in the sense that he's taken him out of context, put him into a method actor kind of mode, who could talk to anybody, based on, his acting this out. He wasn't really sincere and all of that kind of thing, although he does mention in the book that Malcolm was sincere, and that's how people looked at him. And it's just really a problematic book. Too many things, thrown in there for controversy and conversation, and a lot of people been praising and a lot of people been criticizing, and a lot of people have avoided the argument that I think only Dr. Karenga made, that it's a philosophical one. And it depends on what philosophy you coming into this study with. And Dr. Marble came in with a deconstructionist kind of philosophy. And he deconstructed Malcolm and dealt with a whole lot of image-making lies and fairy tales and other things that, it distracted from the message and the meaning of this brother.
Right. Yeah, I remember.
That's the whole problem. Yeah, my whole problem with the book.
Right. Yeah, I remember when the book was going to come out, what was really exciting was that he was going to have the opportunity to see those chapters of the book that Alex Haley didn't include. I think it was because of the publisher, didn't include in the autobiography of Malcolm X, the definitive work, so to speak.
Yeah.
Although there have been other really wonderful works, as I was speaking with Peter Bailey, the book that he contributed to or helped with the writing of Seventh Son, a family memoir, which was written by Malcolm X's sister and son, his nephew. And then, there had been the book that came out after he was killed, which is a compilation of, of essays and sermons and articles about the various periods of his life. And Amir Baraka wrote in a really wonderful expose. He's such a brilliant writer, and he was going to actually join us, but it didn't work out, but we're going to still try to get him.
I had to apologize because I woke him up this morning trying to call him.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. Oh, my. Oh, okay. Yeah, he got in really late because they're having I think it's the second annual Malcolm X Film Festival in Harlem this week. It started yesterday, Tuesday, May 17th, and it's going to continue. Part of it's going to be at the Schomburg is doing something as well on May 19th. But the Film Festival is continuing at a theater that's right there on Malcolm X Boulevard. In New York, in Harlem, which is I think it's so hot. You like to be in on the space, right there,
in New York.
geographically, where you can feel the energy of the brother. I'm like, wow, that is so awesome. But oh well, we just have to do it.
Just to comment on the three missing chapters. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah, that's where I was going.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, the three missing chapters. They're in the possession of an attorney who bought them from the Haley estate back when Haley's it was revealed that he hadn't paid taxes and all of that kind of stuff. And the brother bought them, I think, for $300,000. And he can't publish them because of the, you know, the intellectual property thing. And so he had them in his safe, and Marvel was able to view those kind of things, those documents. And that's what I thought he was going to put out here for us to see, you know, what his review was. And he mentions them throughout the book, but he trivializes them, I guess. And the way he presents them, he sees Malcolm as somebody who's trying to get away from the title Black Nationalism or Black Nationalist and be an internationalist of sorts and, you know, a person without a country kind of person and a, or a commitment. And he was wavering, and he had this problem where he reinvented himself and, you know, tried to be the embodiment of the hustler, trickster, preacher, minister, self-invented person. And he used these as effective ways to reach the masses, not his sincerity, not his sense of responsibility or his ethics that demanded that he do what he was doing. And it's just those things didn't come up. He mentioned them, and I understand that the oldest daughter is supposed to publish them sometime this year, as well as his journals or travel journals when he was in Africa, two particular periods that we don't know about. And one of the missing chapters is supposed to be on his proposal for unity in the black community, regardless of ideological divisions, based on the Bandung conferences where he was very inspired by that. So the whole thing is that this book, people should read it. They should always read it because there are some things we can get out of it. But avoid these little silly controversies about what kind of cereal he liked to eat in the morning. You know, or if he ate cereal in the morning and that kind of thing, because that distracts from the message and meaning of this brother. And he's the model, in my interpretation, a path that we can all follow if we get away from the silly stuff. And there's one other book that I'm sure is coming out. I'm not sure when, but that's by Dr. Coringa, who's avoiding this kind of, what did he call it, scavenger history. This bottom feeding kind of attitude that some people have developed to try to explain the brother and not really deal with him. But go back to the same quote where, you know, his ability, the devil's strongest weapon is his ability to conventionalize our thought. And I think that's what's happening here. We've got a reinvented Malcolm from a brother who spent over 20 years almost doing the kind of research and work that a lot of us are unable to do. And take apart, and then he deconstructed Malcolm so badly and then put the pieces back in such a bad way that we really have a problem with the book. And I read Baraka's piece, which I was impressed with. So I'm telling you, you know, I'm sorry I missed Brother Bailey and all them, because I really would have liked to hear what they had to say. But, you know, we struggle on. It's a good day to struggle.
It's just the whole idea. We were speaking yesterday about the whole Western notion of deconstruction and reassembly, because the fragment is easier to deal with than the whole, and African people are more holistic.
Yes.
You know, we're about the whole people, the whole population, and Al-Haj Malik was about unity, about umoja, not just one individual, but the whole community. Pan-African, not just in this region, you know, Western culture, which includes America and the Caribbean and the southern part of this particular hemisphere, as well as those of our people that have been spread out because of the transatlantic or European slave trade, not to mention the colonization of our people that never left home, you know. So he was about the whole people as opposed to just a part of it. Whereas Western culture, you know, the way we, you know, intellectually, the way we handle things is we take it apart and, like you say, try to put it back together. And you said, you know, well, they didn't put it back together in a correct way, but why take it apart in the first place except, you know, to study so that you can better understand, not to dissemble, to confuse and distort, which is what comes about a lot of times, and that's what happened with the Marble piece, is that it's the image of El-Hajj Malik is distorted. But in our since we don't have a lot of time, I would like you to talk about, because you know, this is a brother you really love, and I want you to have some time to just sort of reflect on what you love about El-Hajj Malik and why you have made it your business to, like, anything he's written, like I said in the beginning, been written about him, or any films. I mean, I watch Make It Plain, and that whole section, the whole phrase, Make It Plain, how he always wanted folks, when they introduced him, you know, just make it plain. You know, like, you know, keep it simple, keep it succinct. You know, don't go over and over these other things. You know, like, just make it plain so everybody can grasp it. So tell us, you know, what it is about this brother that you love so much.
What I love about Malcolm so much is, one, his incisiveness and able to take the complex and make it simple. A lot of us, you know, want to, you know, talk all day and not really be clear. But Malcolm was very, very clear in what he said, as you just pointed out. When he said make it plain, he meant make it plain and not, you know, getting in subterfuge. Another thing I like about him is his discipline. He was very, 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 very disciplined, Zulu-type discipline, where he could, you know, go a distance and keep on going and just keep his sharp focus, another piece. And then his constant being a student, he always wanted to learn. You know, no avenue was close to him, and I think in the autobiography he said if he had the time, he would like to just sit down and read. You know, but then he didn't say, but I'm sure he meant that he would also want us to know what he read so he can share it with us. And then his commitment to our people, not based on awards or anything, but knowing the history and understanding the history, which was, you know, one of his key phrases of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all research. And that's the thing that I think that I know I love about him, because I'm always reading myself, and especially in history. And then another thing I like about him is his forward vision, and he always tried to face facts, as he put it, no matter, you know, as they unfolded, not because they were somebody else's facts, but as they unfolded before him. And then the last thing I guess I could say is his ethical kind of stance. It was right for him to do what he did historically, culturally, and socially. As you pointed out, his whole life was one not of reinvention, but of creation, you know, trying to create the categories and the possibilities within those categories for us to advance the liberation struggle. He was the embodiment, as Ossie Davis called him, our black prince. Not because he started riots or anything like that, but because he provided us with an incisive way of looking at the world and acting and thinking in the world. And I think that that's key to all of what we do. We can talk all day, but if we're not practicing what we're talking, then we're not talking. We're not really doing anything but absorbing more air for useless conversation. And I think that this 600-page book gives us a little insight, but not as much as I expected. I'm telling you, I was really looking forward to seeing this, and now that I've seen it, I don't want to see it. So, but,
right.
You know, his ability to transform himself into the kind of person, human being, African, that he was supposed to be, because, as you point out, he tried to be holistic in his presentations and make it plain so we wouldn't get lost. And he was talking to, when I say we, I mean us, the people that he loved and gave his life to for, willingly, not reluctantly.
Right.
So all
yeah.
of that kind of stuff is what I would say.
I'm going to let you stay in the studio. I'm going to welcome on Abraham Burton. How are you?
Hey, how's it going? All right?
Good morning, brother.
Things are good.
All right.
Abraham, meet Yusufu Mosley from Chicago right now.
Yes, sir. Good morning, brother.
Good morning. How are you doing, brother? It sounds beautiful, everything you were just talking about, you know?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Love that, brother.
Yeah, I can tell. We can feel it, you know?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Abraham is going to be coming to the San Francisco Bay Area for the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival. Is it the 10th one, Abraham?
I'm sorry?
Is it the 10th anniversary of the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival?
You know, I'm not 100% sure what anniversary it is, but I know that I had did it last year, or maybe perhaps it was the year before, and it's a wonderful festival,
oh.
You know.
Oh, so you're returning. Oh, my goodness, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, I was there. I think it was 2 years ago, and it was just all the different activities that they had going on. It was so positive. I remember speaking to some of the people. I mean, everyone was there, and everyone was really having a good time. They had all types of different events for all people, all ages, all colors, you know, all ethnic backgrounds. I mean, it was really happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and you're in New York right now, where the Malcolm X Film Festival just kicked off yesterday, and it's tonight and tomorrow. You're going to be leaving.
Yeah, unfortunately, I won't be able to attend any of that. Yeah.
I want to tell our audience a little bit about you. Abraham Burton's Cause and Effect, the album Spirituality, Folk Sounds, attains its buoyancy and gravity through the group's striking rhythmic fluency, thriving on infectious, hypnotic, shape-shifting dance. And that's a review from Aaron Reamer of Jazz Times. We're going to actually play the title track of that at the end of the conversation, Cause and Effect.
Cool.
In a very rare and important visit to the Bay Area, saxophonist Abraham Burton, along with bassist Eric Rivas and drummer Nasheed Waits, bring their dynamic trio to the Eastside Culture Center on Sunday, May 22nd. But on Saturday, May 21st, they will be performing at the Malcolm X Jazz Arts Festival, which starts at 11 o'clock and is at San Antonio Park, which is located on 19th Avenue and Foothill, in sort of like the San Antonio Fruitvale area of Oakland. And it's a big park. It takes up a few blocks, and it's a free event. And it's just, oh, my goodness, as Abraham was remembering, reflecting, it's fun for the whole family. And as you're having fun, you can also pick up information at the nonprofit booth and learn how you can get involved in changing your community, because, you know, Malcolm X was all about change and revolution,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
As well as Umoja. So, you know, Malcolm X Jazz Arts, we're not just having fun. We are, like, using art for social change and social activity and action. So, that's all a part of this, too. As you eat really good food, because there are food vendors, or you spit some rhymes on that stage, or you dance,
right.
Or you just sit in the grass, just relax with your folks, and just, on the main stage. It's just really, really wonderful all-day event that, you just leave feeling so full and so satisfied. It's just fabulous.
Yeah, good energy out there.
Can you
send sure.
some of that to Chicago?
Believe me, we could use it in New York as well,
Yes, sir. But that's great. And it's good that we call forth the memory of this brother, not just the, icon or I forget all the labels they don't put on my brother. But as a model, as a pathway we can walk, I think we need to really stress that, because we keep looking at this model of this person as if he was less than what we are, or something more, maybe, divine. Some people want to make him God. But I think that we need to really make him who he was and what he means to us. Because if we don't, we'll get another reinvented one in a couple of minutes.
Yeah. Abraham, you're a New York native, and you're a graduate of LaGuardia High School of the Performing Arts, and you pursued your development toward a life in music under the mentorship and guidance of the great Jackie McLean,
mm-hmm.
at the University of Hartford's Hart School of Music, where you received your bachelor's degree in music and learned from Mr. McLean the importance of studying jazz history. And then by the early 90s, your professional career was launched with the renowned drummer Art Taylor. Like, oh, my God. What a wonderful drummer. What a wonderful man. What a wonderful musician and artist. Ah. Anyway, you never look back. You worked with John Hicks. Oh, my God, I love John Hicks. Rashid Ali. Oh, another wonderful drummer. We really miss him. Horace Tapscott. Oh, my goodness. Mark Carey is so hot. We love him. Michael Carvin and many others. Two men were staying. And you're also a part of the Lewis Hayes group. Another wonderful drummer, and the Mingus Big Band, which comes here a lot, y'all like us.
Yeah.
And your own ensemble has been recorded on the Indie Records, and your most recent release in 2010 is widely applauded, self-produced, outing entitled Future Dimensions. And on that one, I believe you have a piece for your daughter, right?
Oh, I do. That's right. I do, yeah.
Yeah, Amina. Right,
Amina.
Right. And you also, and you perform on the alto sax, soprano sax in this particular piece. So I want to let you start talking, Abraham. I just love your name, Abraham. Wow, great prophet. So talk about your music. Talk about Elhaj Malik, because you're like there where he was. Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, it's funny, when I think of, you know, well, in the music world, I can remember the first time I believe I had went up to the University of Hartford, and I was just visiting at the time, and Jackie McLean, whose actually his birthday was just on the 17th, he, and he's, I think he's already been gone some 5 years now, I think, you know, but
yeah.
I remember something. A little story that could relate to this very well, actually. I remember I was just looking around the dorm because at that time at the University of Hartford in Hartford, Connecticut, I believe, I mean, I could be, don't quote me on this, but I believe that the black community, probably the percentage was under 10% at that time. You know, I think there might have been just a handful of African-American students, you know. So, I remember we were looking around and, you know, coming from New York, it's very diverse here in New York. So going up there was, it was almost, to be quite honest, a little bit of a culture shock just because also the, just where the mindset was of the students, you know, coming from wherever they were coming from and where I was coming from, it was completely different. But I can remember recalling going in one of the dorms and on the wall it had a picture of Malcolm X. With his face crossed out, and it said, I think it said something to the effect like Malcolm X was a militant leader or a militant man or something like that, something in that effect. And I remember that had bothered me, and I went to Jackie McLean because he was the whole reason why I was going up there in the first place, and he was trying to, you know, at that time coerce me to me and Eric McPherson to join him up there to help, you know, fatten out the African American department, you know. So when we went up there and I saw that and I brought it up to his attention, I was like, well, what's going on up here? What kind of, you know, what kind of attitudes or ideas do the people have up here, you know? And I remember he sat me down, and I remember he was just explaining to me. He says, listen, Abe. He said, there's a lot of things going on in the world, and you can't let these things deter you from what it is you want to do in life, you know.
Yeah,
and he said, whatever the mentality is of these people up here, he was like, that's all the more reason why we can use you up here, and we need you to be up here to represent, you know, the community, and to be a positive role model, and to be a diligent student, and to do your very best, and so on and so forth. And I remember that after that, I said to myself, okay, I'm gonna attend the school, and I'm gonna see what it's all about. And it was a very difficult environment to deal with. But I remember I stuck very close to Jackie McLean, and as much as he was all about music, I think he was even more, it was more of an urgency for him to pass down a lot of very important facts and about history, and it was very important for the music, for you as a, for, you know, the student as a human, as a person, but also just to be able to have that knowledge and then to take that knowledge and pass it on as well. So I remember Jackie McLean was always, I mean, in his classes, he had the African-American history course that was mandatory for us to take. And you're supposed to take it for 1 year. I took it all 4 years that I was there, you know. And,
wow.
Yeah, because it was mind-blowing. And to be honest with you, I have to be totally honest, I had heard things about Malcolm X or people, you know, a lot of the great leaders, but it wasn't until I got to Jackie McLean's course to the school that I really was exposed to how important these figures were in not only in our history but in world history, and how they really had an impact and affected so many different nations, really, with especially, and of course we're talking about Malcolm X here, and his contribution was unparalleled in so many ways. Of course, I didn't know him as a person. He died way before I was born, but the things that I had exposed myself to learning about him after the fact, I mean, it was unparalleled, really.
Sounds like my journey.
It's wondrous. Oh, my God, Brother Amiri Baraka, how are you this morning?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
Hello?
Yes, yeah. I'm here.
Oh, sorry. He's in the studio, but I can't hear him.
Yeah, I'm on the phone.
Okay. Well, maybe he'll say something and we'll hear him.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm here.
So, Abraham.
Yes.
He's announcing he's here, Wanda.
I'm sorry?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
This is Baraka on the phone.
Hey, I'm Mary Baraka. How you doing?
Okay.
Oh, great.
And I apologize for waking you this morning, my brother.
Well, I was up. I just didn't get to the phone.
Okay. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah. But, I was just saying how important that was in definitely in the curriculum, in Jackie McLean's curriculum, just the history in general of the lineage of this music and just the history, American history.
Yeah.
The real story of American history.
Hmm. Yep. And same with me. I grew up in 1966. I was alerted to Malcolm by my high school geography teacher. And ever since then, I've been everything I can get, read, or whatever I get, read, and whatever, to understand this brother and his contribution to our people and our struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amir Baraka, are you with us?
Yes.
Oh, super. Oh, this is so exciting. Oh, wow. Yusufu Mosley is in the studio along with Abraham Burton. You probably know Abraham. Abraham, do you know Brother Amiri Baraka?
Oh, yes, very well. Yes, sure. Very much so. Very supportive, brother. Always has been.
Oh, wow. So wonderful. We only have like 12 minutes left. So, Brother Baraka, could you could you share with the audience, some reflections on Malcolm X, Brother Malcolm, on the eve of his birthday?
Well, I met Malcolm once in a hotel room with a brother named Muhammad Babu, who was one of the people who led the revolution in Zanzibar. And who then helped put together what is called now the Republic of Tanzania, which was combining Tanganyika and Zanzibar. And he had come to the United States, come to New York, to speak at the UN for the new state. And I met him in that hotel room. It was his hotel room. Malcolm was there, and we talked until the morning, Malcolm was one of the greatest persons in my life. I think the two greatest persons in my life politically have been Malcolm X and Fidel Castro. I think for that generation of mine who was growing up, those were the two people. And then when Fidel was smart enough to actually come up to Harlem and actually be in the Teresa Hotel and meet with Malcolm, that confirmed for me that this man was a great leader. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm, throughout his life, always provided for us an alternative to, because we grew up watching the civil rights movement, and although we loved Dr. King down in Montgomery when, they blew up his house after the bus boycott, and the black people showed up with the rifles. Dr. King, what should we do? Dr. King said, if any blood be shed, let it be ours. I wasn't with that, you know what I mean? So it was Malcolm who really appeared, 1960, Malcolm, that Mike Wallace thing. And like, you know, Malcolm said, you treat people like they treat you.
Hmm.
They treat you with respect. You treat them with respect. They put their hands on you, send them to the cemetery. And my whole generation said, amen. That sounds very profound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was what set us rolling. And then remember, that was a period of great struggle, great turmoil. I don't think there would have been a Barack Obama without Malcolm X and Dr. King, you know what I mean, and Fannie Lou Hamer.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know,
Brother
a particular
Ben?
Impact. Excuse me?
Oh, no, go ahead. I was going to say, ask you a question, but go ahead.
No, that's all I was going to say is that generation, that decade of people fighting is what permitted somebody like Obama. You know, though some of the things he's done disappoint me, but still, I remember George Bush, and I see that lineup of fools they got running up the Republican Party, so you just got to grin and bear it at this point, you know. But I'm just saying that my memory of Malcolm is that he was one of the true leaders of that period who provided a concrete, practical way of dealing with the United States, self-determination, self-respect, and self-defense.
Yeah.
And that always struck me as very clear.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, you know, what was it like to sit in the same room and talk all night with Brother Minister Malcolm? You know, all I have is tapes and speeches and things.
Hmm.
It's something that you know, remember all your life. See, that's why I'm able to recite it that clearly now because, see, I went in there and I was being super militant. I was going to put down an ACP and all that. And Malcolm said, no, you need to be trying to join them. You need to be trying to get them to go in a more progressive direction. You know, the most important thing Malcolm said is the value of developing a united front because, you know, he was out of the nation then.
Right.
And he began to understand the profundity of trying to build a united front of various kinds of ideological, groups and directions because he had come to the conclusion that no single ideological, direction would be strong enough to fight, I mean, to win the struggle that we were fighting. And it's ironic that the last time I saw Dr. King, I talked to Dr. King a week before he was killed, and he said the same thing. And Stokely Carmichael always said the same thing. We need a united front. We have to get these people to drop their sectarianism and agree on what the most important things we have to accomplish jointly and strive to do that.
Wow.
So,
thank you for that.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
that's to
talking.
Me. Mm-hmm. I'm saying
no,
that, that was the most important thing to me was that. It's New York, but I don't know the number. I'm just saying that was the most important legacy in my mind, intellectual legacy in my mind, you know, and it's something that we have to take up. See, the thing about United Front, without some kind of United Front, Obama wouldn't be the president now. He had 90% Afro-American, 65% Latino, 60% Asians, and that group of progressive white people, and all of those are minorities, but that's the coalition, that's the united front you need to keep American politics in motion.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. Thank you for that, Brother Amir.
I was wondering, and we only have a few minutes left, I was wondering in our closing comments, I was wondering if Abraham and Brother Baraka, two in particular, if you could reflect on the impact of Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, and politics on your work, you know, your artistic work, and on your life, you know, sort of. You said, Brother Baraka, that that this is like a moment that you'll never forget. And you've lived through a lot of movements, I mean, quite a few movements. You've seen revolutionary movements in this country come and go and come and go. And I was wondering if you could sort of reflect on that and the revolutionary movement, the Black Arts Movement in particular, you know, which you played a real pivotal role, but then you've got, you know, quite a few other movements that have come and gone that you've also had your stamp in. So if you could sort of maybe give
the Panthers,
art some kind of context. Mm-hmm.
So the Panthers actually are Malcolm's children, just mm-hmm. like SNCC was Malcolm's, you know, outgrowth of Malcolm and the organization that I led, the Congress of African People. All those are Malcolm's children. Those are people directly influenced by Malcolm X. And it's interesting that this week there are all kinds of programs in light of his birthday coming up, the 19th, but also in light of the fact that your book, a book came out by Manning Marable called, Malcolm X, Life Reinvention, yeah, which I, you know, am not thrilled with that book. I mean, because I give you in a nutshell what I think about the book. See, Marable, who's an academic and on the left, he thinks, never understands the Black Liberation Movement, although he couldn't appreciate the Social Democrats, the Communist Party, this and that. But the impact that the Black Liberation Movement had, you understand, whether it was Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or the Panthers or the Congress of African People, SNCC, he never appreciates the impact that the Black Liberation Movement, which no matter what anybody else might say, our book learning about, you know, Marx and Lenin, Mao and so forth, the most profound impact on American society is the Black Liberation Movement.
Mm.
And that I think is what is missing, because you think that, you know, just telling us different kind of odd facts or non-facts or rumors about Malcolm, which you got from the FBI, you know, CIA, boss, the New York Police Department, you understand? First of all, you can't even believe that stuff. If you think that you can just get some kind of, you know, some kind of commentary from those groups who basically are opposed to Black liberation, you know, if you think you can just access, at one time, my wife and I got 3,000 pages at 10 cents a page. And she pointed out, she said, well, look, that stuff they got blacked out and that stuff they let you see. How do you know that the stuff they let you see is not there to disorganize you or send you in the wrong direction, you know? And that's what I would say, you know, how are you going to sit on a whole bunch of papers provided by the very enemies of your people? And also, I guess, by some enemies from the Nation of Islam who had just, you know, kicked Malcolm out. How do you think you're going to sit on that paper and that's going to help define a person whose known qualities we understand? You understand? His known qualities, the actual leadership of the Black Liberation Movement, we understand that and the politics of that. So don't come up with some kind of odd tidbits from the forces of repression that are supposed to give us, that are supposed to make Malcolm more human, because that's actually negative, you know. So that's my take on it. And there was a panel last night at the museum, film house in Harlem. There's one Thursday at the Schomburg. There's one at Oberia Dempsey's church on Thursday. And I think that's the best thing about that book, is it's causing Malcolm's name to be raised again with fierce, you know, dialogue around it. I think that's the most important thing the book has done.
Mm-hmm. Wow, thank you. Closing thoughts, Abraham? about art and politics?
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. You know, I listen, obviously, again, I'd never had the opportunity to meet or really have any interaction with Brother Malcolm X, but just through readings, you know, materials, his speeches, whatever things I've seen or learned or talked to, you know, great people like Mr. Baraka, you know, listening to the experiences they've had, you know, it seems like, it just seems, there's so many qualities that Malcolm had and contributed to our world, really, you know. And I think one thing that really stands out for me as a kind of an outsider in that respect, it is just to really what he personified, the changes he made within himself, and how he projected those things. You know, it makes you really have to reflect on who you are and what you want to be, and to educate oneself, and to not only and not to only educate yourself, but to then pass it along so that it grows and spreads, so that there's more awareness, you know, and it also gives you more strength as an individual and as a really a people, you know, and I'm talking about of all people, you know, and I think that that definitely has impacted my life quite a bit and my music as well, because I have a great pride in my music and what I want to represent and who I want to be and the message I want to convey as Abraham Burton, you know, in this music, in this art form, which is an African-American art form, you know, and it has lost a lot of those qualities. I know we don't have a whole lot of time to get into all of that, but it really has lost a lot of the qualities in which it had, which it was based off of and where it came from, you know. But that's, again, a whole other topic and a whole other conversation that would take a little more time to get into. But that's definitely how I feel, and I appreciate so much, you know, these gentlemen here, all that they've said and their experiences. I'm just soaking it up, really. I'm enjoying it, you know.
Right. Well, we have to have a reprise of this because we are sort of over time, and I was thinking, Abraham, would you like us to close with Amina or Nebulae?
Oh, wow. Maybe the song I wrote for my daughter could be nice. She'll feel good to know that was played.
Okay.
That's very great music, by the way.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much, Brother Baraka and Yusufu, for joining us today. And Abraham, have a safe journey to the West Coast.
See you
good
soon.
Luck,
see you
Abraham.
Soon. Thank you, brothers. Thank you.
Good luck,
thank
Abraham.
You. All right.
All right.
Peace and blessings. Well, that seems to be the end of that broadcast. we must have run out of time. But I wanted to mention that Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is tomorrow, January 15th, and a friend of mine sent me a poem, Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, and I wanted to share the poem in its English translation. He actually writes in bilingual, but I don't want to do an injustice to the Spanish. But it's called After the Lecture, and it's from Martin Luther King Jr., and this is how it goes. And I wanted to also mention that sometimes people say that El Hajj Malik El Shabazz and Martin Luther King Jr. were antagonists, and actually they were not antagonists. They just had different strategies, and El Hajj Malik El Shabazz was supportive of Martin Luther King Jr.'s work, and actually met with his wife, actually called her and told her, you know, that if there was anything that he could do to help support them, that he was willing. And he never got an opportunity, as far as I know, to meet with Martin Luther King Jr., but that might have, he didn't want to, El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz didn't want to, his presence to interrupt or just take away from
Martin Luther King Jr.'s work. So anyway, that we are talking about Martin Luther King Jr. on a program that is reflecting on Incongruent. So after the lecture by Rafael Jesus Gonzalez for Martin Luther King Jr., a woman said I was not polite to the opposition, that I was harsh and did not encourage discourse. Perhaps if I were Christ, I could say forgive them, for they know not what they do. For the queen, and apologize for stubbing my executioner's toes, but only if I knew the executioners were mine only. What courtesy have I the right to give to them who break the bones, the souls of my brothers, my sisters, deny bread, books to the hungry, the children, medicine, healing to the sick, roofs to the homeless, who spoil the oceans, lay waste the forests and the deserts, violate the land. Affability on the lips of outrage is a sin and blasphemy I'll not be guilty of. And again, this is Rafael Jesus Gonzalez. So we want to continue to reflect on the legacy of great men, Elijah Malik El Shabazz, Martin Luther King Jr., and of course the recently departed Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones. And if you're in New York, definitely you want to go to the wake and the homegoing this Friday and Saturday.